Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The governor of Missouri has deployed the National Guard to Ferguson. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer. The move comes after another night of violent confrontations between protesters and police in the Missouri town, and just hours after pastors and police called for reconciliation and healing from the church pulpits on Sunday.
We live in a time where diversity sometimes is not accepted, but it's important for us all to get along.
Later on in the hour, I'll talk to pastors from churches in and around Ferguson, Missouri. Congressman Jerry Nadler also joins us to talk about his proposal to ban tourist helicopters along the Hudson River. We'll look at the dollars and cents of the on-demand gig economy and how hard it is to schedule enough tasks to really make a living. And we'll take your calls on your Only in New York love stories. But first, we want to take a closer look at resisting arrest and the balance between maintaining order and responding to aggressive policing. One of the central unknowns about the shooting death of Michael Brown, an unarmed teenager, is what happened immediately before it. There are conflicting stories about his confrontation with Officer Darren Wilson, when the shots were fired, and what the circumstances were immediately leading up to them. In the case of Eric Garner here in New York, there was a video that showed the slow buildup, the back and forth between Garner and police during questions, and the quick transition to a physical confrontation when police moved to arrest him. Here to talk us through the rules and the gray areas of how we define resisting arrest is Gene O'Donnell. He's a former police officer who now teaches at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Welcome back to WNYC, Gene.
Good to be back. Good morning, Anna.
So in both cases I just mentioned, Eric Garner and Michael Brown in Ferguson, police questioned the men for minor offenses. Brown for jaywalking down the middle of the street in Ferguson, Eric Garner for reportedly selling illegal cigarettes on Staten Island. When police officers are trained, what is the guidance on dealing with people who resist questioning? Does the seriousness of the initial suspected wrongdoing have any bearing on the response to resisting?
Well, I mean, in the Garner case, presumably they had probable cause to make an arrest. They had been asked to do that. I think there was a report in the Daily News yesterday. There were multiple complaints there. Assuming it's important enough to do that enforcement, which I have serious reservations about, but that's the commissioner has endorsed it. I haven't heard any elected officials say they shouldn't do it. So they're going for it, making an arrest, loose cigarettes. Again, I don't know why street cops are doing it, but if they have probable cause to make the arrest, it's a priority. They can use as much force as they need to effect the arrest, and people can either actively resist or passively resist. They have to sort of figure that out, try to de-escalate, try to talk if they can. But we should not delude ourselves. Any enforcement comes with risks, whether you're talking about jaywalking, whether you're talking about pulling people over for, you know, not having seat belts, if there's a lack of cooperation, there can be an escalation. At the root of all policing is force. That's what makes the police different than everybody else.
Force. We are taking your questions and comments on resisting arrest, how police are trained to respond to people resisting them, their questions and their arrests, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Tell us about your experiences with the police and where you think they should draw the line. You mentioned Commissioner Bratton, Gene. On the show last week, the commissioner told Brian about what he saw as a culture of New Yorkers resisting police in high crime areas. This is about a minute long of tape, but let's take a listen.
There's no denying that the law-abiding residents of even some of the high crime neighborhoods of the city are concerned about police behavior when dealing with the criminal elements or the violators in their community. And that's the challenge for the police, because sometimes, unfortunately, all too frequently, in the case of thousands of instances, the people were attempting to, if you will, interrupt their behavior, whether it's an admonition, a summons, an arrest, sometimes basically push back, fight back, resist. And that's what draws an escalating behavior on the part of the police. Police are empowered to use force to effect an arrest. They are empowered to use force to protect themselves or the public. And a significant part of what we're seeing currently is increasingly, it appears over the last several months, a number of individuals just failing to understand that you must submit to an arrest, that you cannot resist it, that the place to argue your case is in court, not in the middle of a street in a neighborhood somewhere.
So there's a lot in there, but the first thing I want to ask you about that the commissioner said there is he says whether it's an admonition, a summons, an arrest, sometimes basically pushback, is the police commissioner saying there it's never appropriate to question an officer to say, look, man, I'm not doing anything, or is he saying that's basically inviting force?
Of course you have a right to question the police, and of course you have a right to have your doubts. The issue is, you know, physical resistance, and really we need to reimagine arrests. We need to leverage technology. Basically, what you have right now is a system where you do punish people, and then later on, often the charges are dropped. You're arresting people, you bring them into custody. Sometimes they get injured. We should be able to leverage technology at this point to release people right away. It would be much less adversarial. The idea that in this late age, 2014, we're still physically dragging people into court, and it's mostly poor people, let's face it. Wealthy people don't generally get the hard end of the system. And even, you know, white-collar criminals can surrender. So we need to it's deprofessionalized the police to have all of these kinds of, you know, conflict points. And we need to try to find ways to get the police out of conflict. You can still impose penalties on people, but these scuffles in the street, we need to really try to be creative in reducing them to an absolute minimum.
What would that look like in the case in Ferguson, for example? A police officer is trying to enforce transportation rules, get Michael Brown, he says, out of the middle of the street for jaywalking. And what would a reimagined arrest look like in that case?
Well, Ferguson, I don't know, and I'm sure some of your listeners have been in places where you can actually attract attention by walking in the street. For some reason, it really raises the hackles of some of the police, and of course that's the capriciousness that scares people about the police. There should be a compelling reason for intervening in people's lives and asking them what they're walking in the street for, and you know, too often these kind of minor offenses are used capriciously and they're used discriminatorily, and so we have to look at lawmaking. It's unavoidable. We have to. A lot of this brutality is created by this, you know, this legislative factory that we have, state, local, federal, adding rules, adding laws, and then pretending we're shocked when things end badly, when force is used, when there are bad outcomes. We have to recognize, you know, that again, when you're inserting the police into these things, there's always the possibility of a bad ending.
So you're making the argument that the over-enforcement of minor offenses is setting up police for these bad outcomes.
Absolutely, because frequently American people will say, this is a free country, why are you harassing me? And you'll get more pushback and resistance in minor stuff than you will in serious stuff. So it's all too easy to say, oh, just go out and enforce these rules. But ordinary people some people really panic and get very upset when they and can't believe that the police are, you know, making this into an issue. And also, I mean, even with this Lucy enforcement, assuming that there's some community concerns, it does give rise to the inference that with serious crime not really on the radar screen in New York, the city is super safe, that the police now are going looking for, you know, looking. And again, I don't want to be unfair there because there was some very good reporting yesterday in the news about how many complaints were made about that corner. And you do have issues about who owns the sidewalks. And, you know, people may be laissez-faire about that unless they're homeowners or business people or landlords. They sometimes get very upset about these on-street conditions that other people may, you know, scoff at.
So I want to play you a clip from Mayor de Blasio where he echoed Commissioner Bratton's line about that the point of arguing about an arrest is not at the point of arrest, it's to make that case later on. Here's the mayor speaking last week at an anti-gun initiative.
Arrest is one of many tools. Arrest is obviously not always the best tool, not always the goal. But once an officer has decided that arrest is necessary, every New Yorker should agree to do what they need to do as a citizen and respect the police officer and follow their guidance. And then there is a thorough due process system thereafter.
A thorough due process system thereafter in the courts, presumably. Gene, is there always a bright line in a police interaction between when there's a back and forth with an officer and when you get to the point of arrest?
Not really. I mean, the reality is that if you send 20 different cops out, you get 20 different, endings sometimes. So, you know, where the lines are drawn, some officers are going to be very patient and some officers are going to be less patient. again, you don't want to be too repetitive here, but you know, the more we have these, the more we send the cops forward, the more likely we're going to have bad outcomes. And we have to balance that again with the needs to have the cops involved. But it's very hard to simultaneously send the cops here and try to micromanage these interactions. Very hard to do that.
Do you agree, though, that, once a police officer has interacted with a member of the public who is pushing back, who is, there's now a moment of confrontation between the two, if you were in that situation as a police officer, what are the things that are going through your head about how to make sure you're not being personally threatened and your responsibility to maintain order?
Well, this is the big issue with policing. There's always going to come a time, even for the most, you know, turn your other cheek cop, where somebody's going to say, I'm not coming. And there's no magic act that you can do to get that person in custody. It's always going to be ugly. You can get hurt very easily. You can get your wrist broken. Your back can get injured. Your knees can get injured over basically, you know, a relatively nonsensical arrest that you're, you know, that you have to make. And you have to retain your weaponry. You have a firearm. You can't be wrestling around on the ground with people. So there's a tendency to use more force than is being directed at you, so you can overwhelm the person. But it's just an ugly process, but we need to confront the reality that these are our surrogates. They're doing it in our name. We're sending them out there. We can't, and we also again can't pretend that there's some, you know, touch. You can just touch somebody on the shoulder and they're going to acquiesce. Every cop fears the moment where, or worries about the moment when somebody says, I'm not coming. And in minor offenses, sometimes that's where you get your most resistance.
I'm speaking with Gene O'Donnell. He's a former NYPD officer and professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Kevin, in Brooklyn, what did you want to add to this conversation about resisting arrest?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, it's up to the officers as a person of authority to enact a proper arrest. Because as a person of color, you know, I'm over 40 now, but as a young man, we've all run into situations where just a simple questioning, despite your best efforts of trying to cooperate or you know, follow orders, if the cop is not a good cop, if he's a dirty cop or a nice cop, he can turn it into a situation where, despite your best efforts, you're resisting arrest. They have tactics where, you know, when they're arresting you, they're hitting you with the walkie-talkie, they're breaking your arm, they're putting the cuffs on ridiculously tight, and if you protest in any way, then you're resisting arrest and they start handling you even rougher. And, you know, they turn a situation that you were trying to control into something ridiculous. So, I mean, it's up to the cops who have the authority to enact a disciplined, proper arrest.
And did this happen to you when you were a younger man?
Oh, of course. Almost every person of color can have situations where, you know, you were trying to cooperate, but the cop is, you know, very aggressive, and they turn it into a more tense situation despite your best efforts to defuse it. Because, you know, if you had any sort of role model, you know, you've been taught to not show the cops any aggression, because quite often any form of, you know, protest will be misconstrued by them and turned into a horrible situation.
Thanks so much for your call, Kevin. Tom in Seabright, New Jersey, you're a public defender?
Yes, I was for many years. Now I'm a private criminal defense attorney, but thanks for taking my call. Something that's been lacking in all of these discussions is that police officers don't have carte blanche. They have to obey the law. If they're using illegal force, a person has the right of self-defense. Isn't that true?
Tom, thanks for your question. Gene, what about the right of self-defense if a policeman is abusing his power?
Generally, in New York, you don't really have a right to resist arrest. There's what's called a no-sock law, and essentially you have to come along. And clearly, again, this would be why it'd be good to have technology so we don't have to go down this road, but under the system we have right now, it is, you know, it is our system that people go to court and these things are resolved. If people feel they've been falsely arrested, they can file a notice of claim against the city. They can pursue, you know, civil charges, criminal charges. Obviously, people will say sometimes that those aren't great remedies and they're not realistic remedies, and I would agree that they're not always realistic remedies. But we can't have a situation where we're encouraging people to flaunt, you know, the law to the judges in force and other people in the system, And in the same sense, even though policing can be capricious, you know, there is no other way. We can't have physical confrontations when people don't agree with the wisdom of a decision to make an arrest, especially, remember, in this Lucy case, this was the number, the highest-ranking police people, have encouraged these arrests. This is a priority. So these are political questions also.
It's a matter of policing policy, but I want to make sure I understand when you're pointing to technology as a way to make some of these interactions, arrest interactions, less potentially explosive. How would technology do that?
Technology would work in the part about arrest for people is it's humiliating and degrading, and they feel they've lost, and that we're saying, oh, you're not being judged, but yes, you are, because you're in handcuffs, you're being dragged into a precinct, and a professional police officer, the good ones, will say, look, this is not my issue, I'm just doing my job here. You sign this, we'll see you in court. You may win in court, but the idea that people feel that they're stigmatized and humiliated and degraded on scene, and then telling them, oh, a month later, 2 months later, the charges will be dismissed and you'll feel vindicated. I mean, that really violates the presumption of innocence. And it really is, I think, evidence that we're indifferent, because it is many poor and minority folks there. If we were arresting, wealthier people, middle-class people on a regular basis, I think there'd be a lot more urgency to reform a system that's basically, punish first and figure out what happened later.
I also want to add, City Limits actually fact-checked Commissioner Bratton after he came on the show last week talking about increasing rates of resisting arrest. And according to data from the New York Division of Criminal Justice Services, they found that in the first 6 months of this year, there was actually a 10% drop in arrest for resisting arrest from a year ago. And they noted, of course, that not everyone who resists gets charged, or it might not show up if they are charged with a more serious crime as well as resisting arrest. But I want to ask you about this. You were quoted in the New York Post last week arguing that resisting arrest needs to be punished more harshly. Do you believe that we're letting people off for that?
Repetitive resisting arrest and legitimate resisting arrest. Sometimes people are resisting. They don't mean to be resisting. It's just you're wrestling around with somebody. They're not easy to handcuff. They're large. So sometimes it's not really active resistance. But there are active resistors out there, people that are engaged in fighting the police, want to have a confrontation. And when you have somebody like that, that has to be looked at, targeting the person. I hate to add more criminalization, even though, because I'm an advocate of, decriminalization, the most serious offense is a misdemeanor, and perhaps you have to have, for repetitive people, felony charges, or at least have the DAs isolated out, because, these are fraught with danger, and it's not just citizens who get killed. We had a police officer, in the 90s get killed wrestling around with somebody in a domestic violence misdemeanor, cut himself on a mirror and died before help could arrive. So, lots of officers get disabled on, misdemeanor arrests.
And you've mentioned force and the use of police officers obviously have the right to use force if they feel threatened, physically threatened. Is there, when there's renewed training after an interaction like the Eric Garner case on Staten Island, is part of what police officers are taught to think about is where that feeling of feeling like they might be at risk of being threatened, where that comes from? Is it more likely that a police officer is going to respond with force to somebody who's a large black man, for example, than someone who's a small white woman?
Yeah, I mean, you can't ignore race, you can't ignore size, stereotypes. You have to be mindful of it and work against it constantly. And, one of the issues with police use of force is we're so afraid to acknowledge that it's us, we in society give the police these powers, that we sort of have the cops sort of half-trained on how to do it. Sort of like the militarization of the police argument, too, that we really don't want to own up to the fact that there are situations in which the police have to use a lot of force. And so Commissioner Bratton has wisely and wonderfully said, we're going to spend a lot of time and we're going to look this issue right in the eye. We're going to try to minimize having to use force. But if we do use force, we're going to try to be so good at getting somebody into custody that we can minimize injury. Sometimes decisiveness and, acting sooner rather than later is the way to go in an arrest situation.
It's interesting because you're saying two things, acting decisively when it's time to make an arrest, but you're also saying that over-enforcing small offenses is part of what's causing these interactions to escalate.
Every interaction can, you know, you say to somebody, Ferguson, Missouri, don't walk in the street, get out of the street, and a person says, no, I'm walking in the street, so you're on. And there's not a, you know, there's nobody in America has a magic formula for what you do then. Again, for the most part, the wise thing is to not engage in the first place. One of the things you try to teach the cops to do is when to back out. You really want to go down there, but that has cost too, because there is a truth to the fact that if you challenge people and the police do back down, those people may get emboldened, and the next officer does a challenge that's legitimate is going to have even more problems. So you have to look at that. But, having the police, minimizing their footprint, using them very sparingly, we're deprofessionalizing, we're coarsening the profession, we're making them into muscle, and we want them, the New York City police have a lot of things to do, a lot of service calls, there's a lot of, the radio is busy as heck, and they don't need to be, out there looking for, minor stuff. But again, we do have to remember 311 is a constant source of, New Yorker complaints. And in the old days, people called the precinct, the complaint went in the wastebasket. Now these are documented complaints. So there's pressure on the police. Hey, there's 50, 40, 30 complaints at this intersection. What are you doing about it? So people complained in February, March, and you haven't done anything about it. So again, a lot of this we have to look in the mirror, though. A lot of this goes back to what people are asking for and the schizophrenia we have about policing generally.
I want to bring in Kylie from Mount Clair, New Jersey. Hi, Kylie.
Hi. I wanted to just agree with what the guest is saying in terms of how this might change if these kinds of, arrests or assaults were happening to more middle-class people or, more white people. I just had a recent event crossing the border from Canada into Detroit in a cross-country road trip, and our car was stopped, and, we were made to get out of the car and go through all of these very weird processes that I'd never been through. And when you're faced with the thought of losing your right to your freedom, I mean, it's horrifying, and it is difficult to console yourself in that moment by saying, well, due process, we'll work this out later. And so for young people who are living with this kind of policing every day, I think it's horrifying, and I think that if more people had these kinds of interactions, that we would approach policing differently. So I do agree with what the guest is saying about race and class being a huge issue about, the initial point of contact between police and the citizen.
Thank you for your call, Kylie. So, Jean, how do you go about rebuilding trust if a community, a neighborhood feels like it's being overly policed, like police are overly aggressive? It may lead to more resistance when police are interacting with the citizens. How do you change that dynamic?
Well, just to go back to Kylie might be surprised to know she has no rights at a border. There's really no rights. And that's not the agents deciding that. That's our government lawmakers who decide that. Basically, it's a rights-free zone when you're at a border in terms of the searches. And, good luck with your due process rights. You really don't have any. Again, I think we have a brutal system. It is based on coercion. It's based on force. We need to come to grips with it. We have lawmakers, again, not saying ever when they're passing laws, how is this going to impact the community? What is going to happen when we pass this new fangled law? What is the impact going to be on community, on the relationship with the community? So, and we need to be repealing some laws, and we need to be, looking at some of these statutes and taking them off. And the DAs also need to be more, the Staten Island case, the district attorney ratified those arrests. The Staten Island DA wrote up these loose cigarette arrests. I'm not saying that is a bad judgment. It's just the DA does have the power if he says, wait a minute, he's the elected chief law enforcement officer. He could get the borough commander on the phone and say, I don't think we need to be doing arrests for this. There's a state and city finance department that could do this. We could come up with civil penalties, impose that against this person. We need to really begin to, we had it because of the 90s, we kind of minimized the impact and power of an arrest because we claimed there was a crime emergency. Now that the city's super safe, we need to back away from some of this over-policing and some of this, trivialization of detaining people and taking away their freedom. It's a very big deal to detain people and take away their freedom. It's a fundamentally big deal. And when you minimize it, you're not only hurting the people, but I think it hurts the cops, too, because we're trying to make it into a profession once and for all, and none of this helps do that.
So you make the argument this starts in state legislatures, it has to do with courts, it also, and then that leads to these interactions on the street between police officers and citizens. Given this critique that you have, I wonder, what do you tell the young people in your life what they should do when they are questioned by a police officer?
Well, try not to be in a situation where you're not questioned by a police officer, which is, you know, which is a hard thing to do. You know, try to be respectful. But, you know, I appreciate that, you know, again, this is America and people, it's New York. And, you know, it's a high energy city and people have, you know, there's 8 million people with 50 million different opinions about what should happen. So I don't know. I wouldn't give as much advice to give advice to people who are on the receiving end, but certainly for the police to try to see, you know, one of the things that's obvious is the police encounter some people in the worst circumstances. If the cops could just take a deep breath and just say, why is this person reacting? And also with race. I mean, we got to stop acting like, I mean, policing is usually, we're talking about race relations there, and that has to always be uppermost, you know, in the mind with the caller who said every person of color feels hassled. You know, can cops see that? And, you know, fortunately in New York we do have now a majority, you know, we have a more representative department, so hopefully that helps us along so people can see themselves and the people that they're, you know, they're encountering.
I've been speaking with Gene O'Donnell, a former NYPD police officer and now professor at John Jay College on criminal justice. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Anna. My pleasure.
After the break, we'll hear from pastors who serve churches in and around Ferguson, Missouri.